harmony sounds like music to our ears. The original voice, what does it sound like as harmony? Indeed, harmony sounds like music in our ears. On the other hand, following the general idea of harmony as a potential capacity of human beings, the answer would be that the boundaries of language are absolute, and they are so for good reasons. Here your views on music come into the picture, and I have deliberately selected these views to apply for the individual body and not your theories on the role and function of psychology, neither that of personality. Partly because your work on psychology has been already ransacked by so many others, but also because I think we need to look for a quality of sound where individual expression is concerned, and not so much the quality of psychiatric representation. Furthermore, you once wrote to Louis, "I do practically no anthropology out of office hours, most of my time being taken up by music." And because you also seem to be a bit surprised about this fixation, as it supposedly kept you from your anthropological work on the one hand, but you obviously needed this as a compensation for something missing on the other hand. In this preoccupation with music, you also wrote to Louis, "I somehow feel, in much of my work, that I am not true to my inner self, that I have let myself be put off useful but relatively unimportant trivials at the expense of a development of inner needs and impulses, whatever they are." So yes, of course, music. As Ezra Pound, you too looked for the missing link, the missing element, the one item that would make the text the expression of a living, pulsating human being again. And individual as such. Music. Because its sound perception and creation is necessarily momentous. In spite of the phonetic quality of poetry, music seems to compose more of the relationship between the speaker and the hearer, as it needs to be experienced in its harmony. Words may be ugly, but sounds and mislead tunes become unbearable to the ear. For instance, I would never close my eyes reading an ugly poem, but I am forced to close my ears if my neighbor's stereo pollutes my private space. In this sense, music approaches the individual expression much more than any textual representation, as it enforces presence rather than absence. Textuality, we have seen, can never touch individuals, rather exclude them from a discourse. It is tempting here, of course, to drive on the ancient opposition between orality and writing. Would it not be that most of orality can be seen as secondary discourse, much of it based on the text that it precedes? As you point out, in representative music, it too seems subject to absolutist and programmist views. Absolutists are battling for sheer beauty, and programmists are battling for sheer representation. But in terms of individual expression, like music, what can be accomplished here is the relationship between the speakers, no more, no less than that. In theory, also, one might view the speakers as two totally dissimilar phenomena. They are, of course. They are not more related by difference or mutuality than the thing is related to the arbitrariness of the sign. Speaking suggests a reality, but its justification does not lay in its truthfulness. For, as we know, for the speaker's honesty rests in some harmony between the words and deeds, and not in her words alone, nor in any correspondence between the words and the things, as they are the only means of lying. Such, according to Steven Tyler. Furthermore, through the workings of music, more than through the workings of speech alone, I have noticed you trace the makings of associations which form the temporal ground of understanding, a temporal suggestion of the one reality of the speech event, for as you write, realistic suggestion must make use of the principle of association, and the fact of such association becomes obvious to the listener on reflection. By the musical equivalent of a figure of speech, a feature common to two otherwise totally dissimilar phenomena, the thing symbolized and a certain mass of sound, is made to identify them. It is possible to make one alteration here. This is that it might not be the thing which is symbolized, but the feeling about, as well as the expression of, another. And she speaks back, symbolizing the self as well as the absolute proof that language is non-arbitrary. For language, as we could know by now, is only arbitrary on paper, in writing, but not in real life. Your love for music, which sometimes seems to evolve at the expense of your anthropological work, was not at all a matter of triviality. The question of self-expression, that either seems to fight representation or is fully absorbed by it, is quite consistent with a language that sometimes aids as well as retards us in the exploration of our feelings, as you once called it. But it is also not unlikely that you got caught between the Victorian age and a postmodern age in modernism. Not going forward, not retiring backward. Your description of music seems to be caught between absolutists and formalists, and it resembles very well this type of imprisonment. Exactly this is why it seems that romantic harmony and poetic freedom of the individual expressions are one of the few solutions left. In all honesty, traveling back in time would have meant resorting to a sense of harmony that you yourself did not actually believe possible in your day and age. Traveling into the future would mean resorting to a sense of obscurantism that fears most of all the loss of communication with the other, with the thing, but also the loss of any possible representation. In order to be able to communicate, which is your most sincere wish, it seems necessary to create at least something, like a realistic suggestion, that entails romanticism of sound, as well as representation, as well as emotion, as you wrote. If, for some reason or other, the experience of an auditor has been such as not to make the association obvious, the suggestion loses all force, and the artist, insofar as he is writing merely representative music, has with the auditor failed of success. On the other hand, music able to put us into more or less well-defined emotional states, without such associative intermediation, or perhaps more accurately, the associative links are of so obscure and intimate a nature as never to rise into consciousness. The problem here, I think, is not so much whether music is purely representational or purely emotional, but whether there is something like a consciousness that absorbs it all. In that predicament exactly lies the inescapable power of language. Your description of music suggests that there can be something like a musical balance, and frankly, so does your description of language suggest that there can be something like a linguistic balance. Yet, at the same time, you show that the everyday world has no such balance of any kind. Especially not a cultural genuine one. For that you refer to the past, as you say. But the great cultures, those that have instinctively feel to have been healthy organism, such as the Athenian culture or the age of Pericles, and to less extent perhaps the English culture of the Elizabethan days, have at least tended to such harmony. Okay, good. But what has happened to the American culture besides industrialism to such an extent that the past cannot be retrieved? Or is it basically a Renaissance ideal, sometimes retrieved, then forgotten, then overruled, for instance, by rationality and late Victorianism? Could it be that even in cultures that seem to have harmonious tendency, there already lies the root of its opposites? And how can this be? For everybody desperately needs genuine culture, obviously. Do not mistake my questions for misplaced sarcasm here. I am really serious. A dethroned king does not dissolve the kingdom. The kingdom, you know, it merely changes its succession. Of course, I also would wish for language of modernism to be as naive and temporal as music, or even that language could be, as you described, the most essential feature of music, which is the melodic, harmonic, rhythmic, or the musical idea which serves as an independent, sensuous beauty of its own. A beauty whose appeal transcends our normal interest in the concept itself. Hence, such music amounts to an idealization of some aspect of the external world. To our greeting a friend in disguise is added the much greater pleasure of finding him transported to a higher plane of being. Except, of course, that this friend transported on a higher plane of being in modern discourse is hardly recognizable as a friend anymore. In fact, both he and she have become generalizations which do not exist, but whose existence is constructed through the mirror of our categories and, more dominantly, our texts. Today, anthropology consists largely of texts referring to texts as secondary rationalizations. Oh no, not epistemology. Every text nowadays is a product, a commodity, which does not function as a part of a process of communication, but as a thing, text, bought or sold, and many times not even that. Sometimes I even feel that the danger of a scientific text suggesting a realistic representation of anything is in fact part of the ontology of power and justification in science. The solution to this problem indeed may be underlying your view of music, though it is not all-encompassing, and maybe because of that, it is not all-totalizing. For instance, I agree with you that the composer is unable to force any particular stream of thought on us through a non-conceptualizing medium, except insofar we render into his hands our own individuality of judgment and association. And, as you say, in short, music does not tell the story, but the story rather guesses at the music. You also explain that for this reason the composer might supplement his composition by the aid of a poet. You are quite right to mention that the purely representative ideal is nonsense in comparison to the undetermined nuance in the expression of emotion that music is capable of. And you conclude by posing this question, saying, does not the very potency of music reside in its precision and delicacy of expression of a range of mental life that is otherwise most difficult, most elusive of expression? Nay more, does not music often create nuances of feeling, nuances that add in profound measure to the more external enjoyment of its own sensuous and formal beauty? My point here is that it is not because of the incapacity of music to conceptualize, or the capacity of words to conceptualize, but of the justification of exactly what everybody seems to generalize about, which is the suggestion of reality, so probing, so penetrating, that it becomes reality. The fact that you wrote to Louis that your preoccupation with music was more dominating than your preoccupation with anthropological word might steam from the honest, non-conceptual shape of it. Again, I do not think that this is an opposition between seeing and hearing, rather that it is a matter of convincing, justifying, overpowering by sight, without the choice to surrender individuality of our own judgment and association. And from this it follows that not music alone, but poetry, suffers the same lack of power and disbelief, because they represent emotions. As I explained before, what you wrote about music also concerns poetry, also concerns painting, but not because they are arts in an artificial opposition with the sciences. The different lays in the individual association versus willed representation. Artists try justifying their art as much as scientists try justifying their science. Among the absolutists of today are those that condemn art to genre and science to discipline, which too is a genre. In fact, it is a collective principle that seems to have overcome everything, including any individual expression. Nowadays, time runs against the individual. Here today, gone tomorrow, the result of a linear time, an evolutionary balance, one might say. Every original poet or writer is very quickly embedded into a genre, which encloses evocation, and this also happens to the humanistic scientists. Today, victory depends on the speed of divining the other, and much more, turn him or her into a group, a culture, a stream of thinkers, never of doers, unless it can be labeled as a political form of activism. Any individual expression is immediately claimed by pluralization and purification. Both phenomena once used to multiply the possibilities and nuances on culture by gratifying more categories. Through the concept of genre, in fact, the composer of any form of expression becomes incorporated into the voiceless mass. And though at one time, not so long ago, anthropologists believed that the answer could be found in crossing the different genres, that operation too has become a genre, inevitable. In spite of the free voice of postmodern ethnography, which Steven Tyler proposed as an intention to evoke both reader and writer into an emergent fantasy of a possible common sense reality. Yes, that reminds me so very much of your proposed possibility of music as... To our greeting a friend in disguise is added the much greater pleasure of finding him transported to a higher plan of being. That is to create a mutual attraction purely as a sense of communication, rather than a sense of consensus. Steven Tyler formulated this idea as: it is in a word poetry, not in its textual form, but in its return to the original context and function of poetry, which, by means of its performative break with everyday speech, evoked memories of the ethos of the community and thereby provoked hearers to act ethically. The voice. Probably the only expressive voice of the individual talking to a community, evoking not by rhetoric, but by the very nature of its singularity. Evocation and harmony seems to contradict each other on the one hand, but also evoke each other on the other hand. However, this is not a matter of equality, but rather brings into mind the allegory of David and Goliath, the giant community being evoked by a single voice. Not as the one versus the many, but as the one that acts, coinciding words and deeds, as a matter of sheer irony. This is exactly what modern poetry tried to accomplish. But it is not the effort of the modern poetry alone, because the moment that modern poetry became a genre, it ceased to be evocative and became harmonious. And the temporality of the single voice has existed throughout the history of the Western world. Goethe created Faust to revitalize the single deed of the individual, who preferred deeds as the origin of words. Kandinsky tried to revitalize the single view of the individual by disclosing form at the advancement of content, the retrieval of its original context in painting. In fact, the histories of Europe as well as the histories of the United States have always accomplished events of individual expression. But again, Ezra Pound reminds us of the realms of these brief moments in time, that is. This as inmidmost us their clothes a sphere, translucent, molten cold that is the eye, and into some form projects itself, Christus or John or eke the Florentine, and as the clear space is not a form's imposed thereon, so cease we all from being for the time, and these, the masters of the soul, live on. And I had a meeting with a friend whom I dearly love, though for most in disguise it added to me the pleasure of finding him transported to higher plan of being, to harmonize bodies in an approach to find individualism or individual expression is not a matter of categories pluralized within the totalization of humanity. To communicate socially means to enjoy every part of a person's being and every subtle sensing that is connected to communicating and erotizing, like unfolding of a lotus flower in which every leaf carries its own abstraction and its own essential individual momentum. Every representation thereof could only be like a poem, a painting, or, for all I care, a text. But it is never more, and certainly not less, than the singular creative point in time. Indeed, our individual bodies cannot be split through the categories of science, poetry, and music, for then therein, hidden underneath the surface of what seems social, are individuals who have fallen from the paradise of national genius. Harmony only remains harmonious as a result of the separation of categories. Walt Whitman penetrated poetry with a bold physical presence, which forced American culture to awareness about its erotic presence. Ezra Pound penetrated poetry with a certain amount of intellectualism, and Ruth Benedict penetrated science with poetry, realizing that the harmony of genuine culture could not be attained as the categories of rationality and emotions are interwoven, and they cannot be avoided by separating the genders in childbearing woman and rationalizing man. For in terms of this harmony, she wrote a poem on anthropology, as it was her choice to be an intellectual. Light, the more given, is the more denied. Though you go seeking by naked seas, each cliff etched visibly, and all the waves plunging themselves with the sunlight of this bride, light makes her sophistries. You are not like to find being fed always that she shines on, only those storm-driven down the dark see light arise, her body broken for the rainbow bread at late and shipwrecked closed. And you answered, Ruth Benedict. I shall keep my dreaming. Last night we walked under sun-tangled branches hand in hand, and our two palms made music while we talked of quiet things the nothingness shall withstand. All futile years that leave no other thing at crest of being with unbroken wing.